This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Das ist Ihre Millionenchance. Jetzt im Lotto-Jackpot. 26 Millionen Euro. 26 Millionen Euro.
Lotto Bayern. Nimm dein Glück in die Hand.
Spielteilnahme ab 18. Chance auf den Höchstgewinn 1 zu 140 Millionen. Glücksspiel kann süchtig machen. Hilfe unter bjuk.de.
We focus on the part of the internet that most people don't know about. It's called the dark web.
Undercover in the furthest corners of the dark web. US special agents are on a mission to locate and rescue children from abuse.
Move in now.
Police!
From the BBC World Service, World of Secrets, the darkest web follows their shocking investigations. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Last week, the American news website Axios suddenly ran a story saying that there was a new peace plan for Ukraine, that the US had signed up to it, and here were the leaked details. It was supposed to be the brainchild of a Trump envoy called Steve Witkoff and a Russian businessman called Kirill Dmitriev. One look at the plan told the world that it appeared highly favourable to Russia. What followed seemed chaotic. Within hours, its status had been downgraded, its origins questioned, and a counterplan drawn up. So what is or was the Witkoff-Dmitriev Pact? What's happened to it? What does it tell us about the Americans, the Europeans, the protagonists themselves, and the prospects for peace? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, let's look at where this peace plan came from. I'm joined by Angela Stent, who's a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, an independent think tank in Washington, and she's a former American National Intelligence Officer for Russia and Eurasia. Angela Stent, can you take us through the events of the past week in terms of how this peace plan emerged?
Well, it's quite dizzying. A week ago, Axios, which is a popular media outlet here, published a leaked version of this peace plan. And then immediately there was a flurry of activity. Then the next day, Friday, Dan Driscoll, who is the Secretary of the Army, was sent to Kiev to brief both the Ukrainians and the European ambassadors in Kiev about what this plan held. He apparently had to be schooled before he went on the history of the conflict because he was not familiar with it. Then, of course, the Ukrainians were very concerned about this draft. The Europeans were very concerned about this draft. And so on Sunday in Geneva, there was a meeting both between American negotiators and Ukrainians, and European leaders were present. The national security advisors were present. But essentially, the US and Ukraine then drafted a different version of this initial 28-point peace plan, which then had 19 points. Apparently, by now it has 22. The Europeans drafted their own. So the Ukrainians said, fine, we agree with this new plan. And then, of course, the Russians, via the foreign minister Sergei Lavrov, said there are a lot of things that we don't like in this new plan, and we have to have further discussions. And so now Stephen Witkoff, who is the main negotiator with Russia, a real estate businessman, will be going back and meeting with President Putin, with whom he's met, I think, at least five times. And then Dan Driscoll will be going back to Kiev and meeting with the Ukrainians. And they're supposed to then work out another draft of this peace agreement that will be acceptable to everybody.
So, Angela, to what extent were some of these people involved in the Gaza peace plan? And I think also Trump's son-in-law comes into this somewhere.
He certainly does. So what happened was the original plan was apparently worked out in Miami at the end of October. So Mr. Witkoff and Jared Kushner, President Trump's son-in-law, had just completed the Gaza peace deal with Israel, and they were flush with success, if you like. And then they flew straight to Miami, and there they met with Kirill Dmitriev, who is the head of the Russian Sovereign Wealth Fund, who has been negotiating with both Kushner and Witkoff for some time, we understand. And they then hashed out this plan. And Mr. Witkoff said, you know, we had this 20-point plan in Gaza and it's worked so well, and we're going to do the same thing for Ukraine. But other people say a plan similar to that has been circulating for months.
Now, let's go back to, therefore, the original plan as it was leaked on that day. What were the key points in it?
So the key points that were unacceptable for Ukraine were the territorial sacrifices. Ukraine would have to give up land in the Donbas, which Russia does not control. Giving Russia control of the whole Donbas region in eastern Ukraine, which Russia has been trying to take actually since 2014 and still has been unable to take. Secondly, it would have to say that it would never join NATO, and NATO would have to say that it would never, ever try and admit Ukraine. Then there were things like, and this is why so many people think this was actually written in Moscow, and we also had a leaked phone call now between the National Security Advisor to President Putin, Yuri Ushakov, and Kirill Dmitriev, the head of the Sovereign Wealth Fund, talking about how they were going to write this draft. Of course, the Americans might change it a bit, but that was the basic thing. So things like all Nazi ideology and activities must be rejected and prohibited. Well, the Russians call the Ukrainians Nazis. There were sort of vague promises of security guarantees for Ukraine by the United States, but Ukraine would have to pay for them, and the United States would use $100 billion of the $300 billion in Russian frozen assets to work on reconstruction in Ukraine, but the U.S. would get 50% of the profits. Then this sentence again reads like it was translated from the Russians. It is expected that Russia will not invade neighboring countries and NATO will not expand further.
You can just imagine Vladimir Putin saying, well, I didn't expect to have to do it.
Right, exactly. And then Russia will be invited to rejoin the G8. And the final one, the agreement will be legally binding and it will be monitored and guaranteed by the Peace Council headed by President Donald Trump, which is just what they did in Gaza. So that's a replica of that.
Well, now, that brings me to a very interesting other question. You mentioned previously a leaked telephone call, but there's been another leaked telephone call from slightly earlier, hasn't there? Could you tell us about that?
Yes. So this is a telephone call between Mr. Witkoff as he was on his way back from Israel with Yuri Ushakov, the National Security Advisor to President Putin. Mr. Witkoff, as we know, admires President Putin, he has said so explicitly, and he says things to Mr. Ushakov like, we know that all that President Putin wants is peace. The rest of it is they're just talking about what they might have in this agreement. So there's real coordination between the United States and Russia in this agreement. And then he's telling Mr. Ushakov how best to deal with President Trump. You have to flatter him. You have to tell him what an achievement he's just made. So he's in essence coaching the Russian National Security Advisor on how to interact best with Trump and get what he wants.
Andrew, you're an old hand here. Have you ever heard of anything like that before?
Absolutely not. I mean, this is just unprecedented. And it really has shocked many people in the US and in other countries too.
Angela, call me old-fashioned, because I've been in this business a long time. But I recall the days when, with the US, the Secretary of State ran these kinds of initiatives. We haven't even mentioned him yet, was in charge of the negotiators. When a plan was ready, would probably hold a press conference and tell everybody about it, and everybody would know where they were. This administration is certainly not following that template, so why not?
So this administration is very suspicious of diplomats. They think the State Department is quote unquote woke. I think Trump believes that the State Department tried to undermine him during his first administration. We know how chaotic it is because Secretary Rubio on Sunday called a group of senators who were attending a security conference in Canada and said to them, I don't know anything about this plan. This plan was written in Russia. And then 3 hours later, he reversed himself and said, no, this is a US plan. So he has been clearly left completely out of the loop. I mean, the joke is that the State Department cafeteria is fuller than it has ever been because all these diplomats are sitting around and they're not really being given much to do.
Angela Stent, Before we move on, a reminder about the Briefing Room podcast. If you visit BBC Sounds, you can find the entire back catalogue, such as the one which asks what the UK can learn from European asylum policy, and the one which asks why we have 25 national inquiries on the go.
We focus on the part of the internet that most people don't know about. It's called the dark web.
Undercover in the furthest corners of the dark web, US special agents are on a mission to locate and rescue children from abuse.
Move in now.
Police!
From the BBC World Service, World of Secrets, the darkest web follows their shocking investigations. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Now back to the Ukraine peace plan. I'm joined by Sir Lawrence Friedman, Emeritus Professor of War Studies at King's College London, Christopher Miller, the Financial Times chief Ukraine correspondent down the line from Kyiv, and Sir Laurie Bristow, who was UK ambassador to Russia from 2016 to 2020, and then ambassador in Afghanistan, and is now president of Hughes Hall, Cambridge. Christopher Miller, what do we know about what's in the revised peace plan?
Well, we haven't seen a physical copy of the revised plan yet, but it removes or softens some of the more controversial original points in the first draft that was leaked and that we did see. So most of those points have been agreed by both sides now. The White House has said that only a few delicate issues, quote unquote, remain. But I think that is really downplaying what's left. Like, actually, the last few points are probably the thorniest of all of them. And so those are going to be things like the matter of territory. Russia would like to see the remainder of Donetsk Oblast handed over to it. And that was in the original draft. The Ukrainians obviously do not want to give up territory that they currently control. That will be discussed only by Zelensky and Donald Trump, if and when they meet. The president has made that clear, and both the delegation sides have said that's only for them to decide on. The other is security guarantees for Ukraine, which Ukraine would like to see hammered out and agreed before any deal is finalized. But the Americans seem to be pushing this idea that a deal needs to be agreed first and then a discussion afterward on security guarantees, which doesn't really sit well with Kyiv. And then Ukraine's potential membership in NATO. My understanding is that the language around that has been softened some, but there's still quite a lot of detail that needs to be hammered out. And then a couple of other points, which the two sides, the US and Ukraine, have agreed that Europe needs to be involved in, which are about that NATO issue that I mentioned, and also how to put to use Russia's $300 billion worth of frozen assets.
Lawrence Friedman, what has happened with the original plan and now with this revised plan? What does it tell us about the attitude of the US administration towards Ukraine at the moment?
I don't think there is a single attitude of the US administration. There are a number of attitudes. So we know that Steve Witkoff, who was the main drafter with Kirill Dmitriev of this plan, has expressed his respect for Putin and sympathy for the Russian position, and in the past has tried to push Ukraine into handing over the remaining part of Donetsk. Rubio, Secretary of State, wants to work with the Allies and with Ukraine. There's a new character in the story, Dan Driscoll, who's the Secretary of Army. He doesn't necessarily come in with a negative view to Ukraine, and that's about it. There's not very many other people around, apart from the President himself, who vacillates.
Laurie Bristow, this vacillation, it's very, very confusing to everybody, because at one moment we have Trump saying Putin's a bad guy and he should listen. The next moment we hear him saying that Zelensky should be more grateful and that Ukraine effectively started the war or was responsible for it. You get the original plan, which seems to be a Russian plan. You get this change plan, which, if from Christopher's description, seems to take out most of the things that people objected to in the first plan. What is going on?
Well, that's a very good question, and I can't actually fully make sense of it. I've never seen anything like this. So as you say, what we've seen is this kind of almost wild flip-flopping between Putin is the problem, Zelensky is the problem, we're going to have Putin in Alaska for a summit. That, of course, happened. Then we're going to go to Budapest for another summit. That didn't happen. I think probably what's most helpful at this stage is to try and sort of step back from the rather strange process and try and map out what the elements of a deal might actually be and how you might get to them. And, you know, the most obvious point to underline there is I'm not actually sure that Putin wants a ceasefire. So, you know, all of the negotiation ought to be about how to get him to that point. Everybody else, I think, does want a ceasefire that works for them. And the elements, you know, whether it's 28 points or 19 points or however many it is next week, it comes down to a very small basket of issues. So one, of course, is land. What role does land play in any kind of ceasefire, in any settlement? One is security guarantees. The two things are intricately linked, but simply surrendering land will not deliver security for Ukraine. And this, I think, is pretty obvious to everyone. And there's a whole group of issues around politics and money. So if you go back to the reasons why Putin went into Ukraine in the first place, there's a whole suite of political ambitions there that he set out very, very clearly over the years. Those ambitions will not change. And so the question is, how do you get him to, if you can, getting to at least get to a ceasefire? And then there are all the more technical issues around what happens in what order, sequencing, you know, through and beyond an agreement.
Chris Miller, what do the Ukrainians make of where the Americans currently are? I mean, immediately after the plan, there was that speech from Zelensky about we have a choice between dignity and allies, which seemed very, very kind of gloomy. Is that where they are?
There's a lot of exhaustion here from the years of war. There's this sort of whiplash element of being pulled in one direction and then another by the Trump administration. We've seen this real oscillating position by Donald Trump himself and his administration. And Ukrainians now view the Americans not as their staunch ally, as they have been for years and decades, right?
Chris, is the problem here that dealmaker Trump has leverage over the Ukrainians but doesn't have it over the Russians?
I think he has leverage over both if he wants to use it. He's just viewing Ukraine as the weaker of the two. You know, the leverage that he has over Russia, you know, would be to apply more sanctions to try to weaken its economy. If it wanted to get more involved militarily, it could send long-range weapon systems to Ukraine to try to allow the Ukrainians to take out more command and control centers, even hit targets as far back as Moscow, St. Petersburg. You know, with Ukraine, the Ukrainians really do heavily rely on intelligence from the Americans. And this is intelligence that can't be replicated by the Europeans. And so pulling that intelligence, as well as potentially halting American military assistance, without it, the Ukrainians really would struggle, even more so than they are, to beat back Russia's larger army, especially as it continues to ramp up production of its missiles and drones and really pound its critical infrastructure right now.
Lawrence Freeman, there was a kind of ghost presence in the original plan and then a bigger presence as in the next kind of iteration, which is, of course, those that of Europe and the Europeans who were kind of given a role in the original plan and who've now been involved since. Could you just take us through how the Europeans view this situation and what they've been doing?
I think you have to go back right to the start of the Trump administration to understand the European role. When Trump came in, he was pushing a ceasefire. I think he thought that Putin was ready for a ceasefire. I think he's had a rosy view of what Putin's ready to accept from the start, and that the problem was going to be Ukraine, who just wanted American weapons to keep on going regardless. And he started to put pressure on the Ukrainians, and the Europeans came in, and I think they played two roles. First, they pushed back on Trump, especially on the security guarantee issue, and try to make it more amenable to Ukrainian perspectives. And they tutored the Ukrainians about how to deal with Trump, which essentially involves lashings of flattery. And whatever you're trying to do, make sure the onus on any failure of the talks goes on to Moscow. I think that was the strategy they came to. It worked. And I think it's carried on working. It's just, you just have to keep on going back there.
Laurie Bristow, isn't the essential fact here that the Europeans actually view this all very much more seriously than the Americans do?
Yeah, well, self-evidently, I mean, it's much, much closer to us than it is the United States. I think, I mean, the Europeans have been struggling all along with a rather bigger set of issues than simply the tactical ones about how to get through, you know, whatever negotiation we're in this week. And for me, it really comes down to the point that whatever happens in this war, however it ends, if it ends, it's the Europeans who are going to be carrying a lot of the risk and the cost at the end of that and for a very, very long time. So, you know, my own view of the current conflict is that you might get to a ceasefire. I think it'd be very good if we could get to a meaningful ceasefire. But the underlying conflict with Russia will not resolve until Russia changes. And that's unlikely to happen until Putin dies. And that may be many years from now. So what I think we're looking at, the UK and the Europeans, is a really fundamental security of Europe question here, of which Ukraine is part but not the totality. And the overriding interest that we have in that is keeping the Americans as engaged as we possibly can in the security of Europe, but doing that with a Trump presidency who sees the world very differently.
In other words, Europe sees the security of Ukraine, or Ukraine essentially not falling to the Russians, as absolutely essential to its own security.
Yes, it self-evidently is.
Chris, we've had talks now at Geneva which have involved the Europeans. How does Ukraine view European involvement and its centrality?
The Europeans are absolutely essential to this. They're the ones who have stuck with Ukraine and been at their side and are the most gung-ho about seeing it remain independent, sovereign, and a strong bulwark against Russia should it decide that it wants to go beyond Ukrainian borders here, right? And so they have very close conversations with their European counterparts. He knows that he can, to a great extent, but maybe not to the extent that he would like, count on them, and in many ways much more than he can an oscillating Donald Trump. So he wants them as closely involved in this process as possible.
So, Lawrence, let's now talk about specific security guarantees in the revised plan. Mm. What do you understand to be on the table or being offered, and who's it being offered to?
Well, this is an area where the original 28-point plan seemed to offer a bit more to the Ukrainians than one would have expected. And there was another one of these leaks was of the text of a security guarantee that claimed to be modelled on Article 5, the NATO guarantee. Now, it wasn't as automatic in terms of demanding a response if in the event of a future Russian invasion, because it required deliberation to see how serious it was and so on. But in practice, it was, I suspect, more than the Russians would like and probably more than the Ukrainians expected. But we don't know the status of that. The other thing that is going on is the so-called coalition of the willing, which has been led by France and the UK, to come up with a variety of ways to strengthen Ukrainian forces who are supposed to provide the main defence and deterrence in the event of the Russians returning for more. And that involves air power, involves maritime forces, and critically involves not a large amount of European troops being based in Ukraine. The original 28-point plan wouldn't seem to allow the air part of that, didn't say anything about the sea part, and ruled out the land part. And that's where we are. As Chris said, the current leak from the Trump administration is they don't want to do security guarantees until they have a deal. There's no way Zelensky can do a deal without some confidence on security guarantees.
Chris, I think that takes us to where we are on the battlefield in Ukraine at the moment. What's the Ukrainian view of how they are now with regard to the war itself?
Well, the Ukrainians are really struggling. You know, on the battlefield right now, Russia has the initiative for sure. It's pushing forward, even at heavy costs, still deeper into Donetsk region. It's now entered another region, that being Dnipropetrovsk region. It's advancing in Kharkiv region. It's advancing in Zaporizhia region. Now, it's making small gains, but it's still pushing forward at a greater pace than we've seen in the last year and a half. So I think, you know, Russia's grinding away, and that's piling the pressure on Kyiv politically and militarily. Ukrainian forces are certainly on the back foot trying to halt them. They're up against still a much larger, more powerful Russian army, and they're having a heck of a time keeping them at bay. On top of that, Russia's airstrikes have intensified since spring, and now we've seen these massive combined missile and drone attacks on an almost daily basis.
Laurie Bristow, Russia, though, has had enormous casualties. We had quite a lot of talk only a few months ago about the difficulties for the Russian economy. Is it your impression, however, that despite all that, the Russians believe that they're on the front foot and the Russians believe that it's a matter of time?
Yeah. So there are lots of things that have been going wrong for Russia from the outset of the war, you know, starting with the fact they didn't reach Kyiv in 3 days. And they've lost what, a million and a quarter casualties over 3.5 years. And their economy is now being mortgaged to the war. None of that will change Mr. Putin's objectives, unfortunately. I mean, I find it useful to think in a number of timescales here, and I think timescales are becoming very, very important. So Mr. Trump, I think, essentially is thinking about next week. How does he get to that sort of payoff of being the great deal maker? I've got this thing on the table. Putin, I think, is thinking at least into next year. and specifically in terms of how does he not lose or probably win a war of attrition. And the way I think he's trying to do that is essentially, you know, get the Americans to do that for him, to take that question off the table. All the rest of us, we need to think in probably about a 10-year horizon. And the point here is that if you're thinking about what a ceasefire deal might entail, that's not the end of the matter. What we've seen repeatedly in dealing with Putin over the years is that a deal is not the end of the matter. It doesn't resolve the issue. It moves you on to the next stage of the contest, conflict, whatever it is. So what we should expect Putin to do, if there is a ceasefire, is undermine every single aspect of it that doesn't work for him and prioritize every aspect that does. We saw this with the Minsk 1 and 2 agreements. Those were the partial ceasefire agreements negotiated in 2014 after the first explosion of the war in the Donbass. We saw it in Georgia after the invasion in 2008. This is how he operates. And if we don't get that and we don't factor that into any kind of ceasefire deal, we're going to come unstuck.
Chris Miller, how is the corruption scandal in Ukraine playing into this? I mean, obviously, it's going to be dreadful for President Zelensky. How likely is it that it will undermine his position at this critical time?
Well, you know, the interesting thing about these negotiations happening is that it's sort of put the corruption scandal at home on ice very briefly. But Ukrainians haven't forgotten that the president is still embroiled in probably his biggest political scandal of his presidency. It embroils his top senior allies, his former business partner and the co-founder of his entertainment company, several top ministers, all of these people who are really close to the president. You know, what I know from speaking to Ukrainian officials here is that they feel that, one, the Russians and Americans are using this domestic scandal to press Zelensky. They sense his weakness right now, and they're pushing him into making a deal when they think he's at his weakest point politically. And then the other is that Zelensky has used these negotiations to rally support and call for unity.
Lawrence Freeman, one of the things that also occurs to me is that the more that the Europeans get involved, and they have been increasingly involved, and become a significant source of support for Ukraine, the more potentially Europe becomes a target for the Russians. Not necessarily a direct military target, but we've seen some really big warnings from some, including the German Foreign Ministry in the course of the last week. Do we think that the actual direct threat from Russia to other countries in Europe is increasing?
Yes. I mean, the Russians say that effectively that they're at war with NATO, that Ukraine is a puppet, that it's being used against them by the Europeans. And we've seen not just warnings within Europe, we've seen Russian sabotage, we've seen cyber attacks, we've seen information campaigns, we've seen drones. And it's actually now reached the point where European leaders are noticing and trying to work out what they do with it. So, I think one of the themes of what Laurie and I have both been saying is that this has to be viewed in the long term. Ukraine is now a critical part of this. But even if we got a ceasefire tomorrow, this is not a problem that's going to go away. And there's some big issues for Ukraine after a ceasefire, not just corruption, but just, you know, a lot of its population is now abroad. There's a lot of reconstruction to be done. So this is not an issue that will be solved quickly.
Chris, we're coming to the end of the programme now. I just want to know, is there an anticipation, is the expectation in Ukraine that there will be a ceasefire anytime soon?
No, I don't think anybody's holding their breath. You know, the people I speak with from the president's office downward all agree that there likely won't be any real movement on this until spring. They think that Russia, believing it still has the initiative, wants to see through the next few months to see just how much havoc it can wreak on Ukraine's critical infrastructure, what it can gain in the eastern Donbass region. You know, and it doesn't seem as though the Ukrainians are going to be able to really secure a deal here with the Trump administration and with Russia that all three sides can agree on to even get to a ceasefire, again, let alone the sort of big deal that Trump wants to see done.
That's all we've got time for. My thanks to Christopher Miller, Laurie Bristow, Lawrence Freeman, and Angela Stent. And we'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Caroline Bailey, Cordelia Hemming and Kirstine Knight. The production coordinator was Maria Ogundeli. The sound engineer was James Beard and the editor was Richard Varden. And another edition of this podcast will be along again very soon.
After Anthony Easton's father passes away, he goes through his dad's old suitcase. It's filled with cryptic clues, neatly stacked German money, a family tree he doesn't recognize, and also finds his father's birth certificate, but bearing a different name. From BBC Radio 4 and the History Podcast, I'm Charlie Northcote, and I've been working with Anthony Easton to understand his family's dark history and how they lost a fortune worth billions today. What happened to his family, their business empire, and all the money? Listen to The House at Number 48 on BBC Sounds.
We focus on the part of the internet that most people don't know about. It's called the dark web.
Undercover in the furthest corners of the dark web, US special agents are on a mission to locate and rescue children from abuse.
Move in now.
Police!
From the BBC World Service, World of Secrets, the darkest web follows their shocking investigations. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your BBC podcasts.